Your podcast will begin after this short message.
There's been a rise in mental health issues among teenagers. It's become a crisis.
Adults think that things are bad for us just because of the pandemic, but it's more complicated than that, and it's been getting worse for a while.
We here at PBS NewsHour Student Reporting Labs are in a unique position to do something about it, to report on it from our point of view.
I'd feel anxious whenever I was outside of my house.
I would feel like something really bad is going to happen, and I just feel that way the entire day until I go to sleep, and then the cycle starts all over again.
Introducing On Our Minds,
a podcast that's unique because it's made by teens, for teens, all about teens and our mental health.
Listen to On Our Minds wherever you get your podcasts.
Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. 100 years later, the anniversary of the Tulsa massacre renews calls to address the massive and widening racial wealth gap in the U.S. Then a deadly surge. Latin America sees massive spikes in COVID cases across the region after the explosion of the virus in Brazil. Plus, rethinking college. Questions arise about applications and tuition for community colleges amid a precipitous drop in enrollment, especially among students of color.
Financial reasons was the primary reason given for students dopping out. Almost 40% of those students had a scenario where they had to decide between rent, food, and a college expense.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President Biden has spent this day in Tulsa, Oklahoma, recalling the racial massacre on this date in 1921 that left hundreds of black citizens dead. He met with survivors and touted plans for a racial reckoning. We'll have the story after the news summary. The U.S. Supreme Court today refused to hear Johnson & Johnson's appeal of a $2 billion verdict over its talc products. 22 cancer victims alleged that the company's baby powder and other products contain asbestos that cause ovarian cancer. A jury in Missouri agreed. Johnson & Johnson faces more than 21,000 similar lawsuits. Florida is now the largest state yet to ban transgender athletes from girls and women's sports teams in public schools and universities. The new law enables athletes to sue if they lose to transgender competitors. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed the bill in Jacksonville today and argued it's about equity, not discrimination.
It's not a message to anything other than saying we're going to protect fairness in women's sports. We believe that it's important to have integrity in the competition, and we think it's important that they're able to compete on a level playing field.
Opponents charge the law endangers an already vulnerable group. Pope Francis revised church law today to criminalize sexual abuse of adults by clergy. Laypeople who hold church office will also be criminally liable for abusing adults or children. The changes follow scandals over in the Catholic Church over seminarians and nuns being sexually victimized by their superiors. Slaughterhouses across the U.S., Canada, and Australia have shut down after a new ransomware attack. It targeted JBS, the world's largest meat processor. Several large JBS plants in the U.S. stopped slaughter operations today. The White House says a criminal gang in Russia is the likely culprit. On the pandemic, the White House is set to resume full in-person staffing next month, with some exceptions allowed. Meanwhile, the Paycheck Protection Program officially ended today. Overall, it lent nearly $1 trillion to small businesses. The United States today formally ended the policy of making legal asylum seekers from Central America stay in Mexico while their cases are decided. The Trump-era restriction affected thousands of migrants. President Biden had paused the program in January. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 45 points to close at 34,575. But the NASDAQ fell 12 points and the S&P 500 slipped too. Still to come on the NewsHour, what the Tulsa massacre reveals about economic racial disparities today. how to combat a massive spike in COVID cases across Latin America. Questions arise about community college tuition amid a precipitous drop in enrollment, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
And now to Tulsa, a century after a storm of racial killing engulfed the city. The president's visit today came as the nation is reassessing race relations, past, present, and future. White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor reports.
100 years after the Tulsa race massacre, President Biden came to mark one of the darkest chapters in American history.
For much too long, the history of what took place here was told in silence, cloaked in darkness. But just because history is silent, it doesn't mean that it did not take place. And while darkness can hide much, it erases nothing.
He's the first U.S. president to travel to Tulsa to do so. He acknowledged the scars seared onto the nation's conscience.
Private planes dropping explosives. The first and only domestic aerial assault of its kind on an American city here in Tulsa. Eight of Greenwood's nearly two dozen churches burned like Mount Zion. My fellow Americans, this was not a riot. This was a massacre.
Mr. Biden also met with survivors of the massacre. In 1921, from May 31st to June 1st, a white mob rampaged through the Greenwood District in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was once a thriving African-American community known as Black Wall Street. The violence killed as many as 300 black people. Thousands of black families were left homeless and fighting for survival, and 35 city blocks lay in ruins. A century later, Mr. Biden's visit came amid a national reckoning on racial justice in the aftermath of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis last year. The president has pledged to do more to address racial inequities and to try lessening the racial wealth gap. A survey released last year by the Federal Reserve found the median wealth of black families is less than 15% of white families. The median for white families was $188,000, compared to just $24,000 for black families. Today, the Biden administration announced several new initiatives aimed at tackling those disparities, including an effort to combat inequity in home appraisals and housing discrimination, boosting the share of federal contracts by 50% over 5 years for small and disadvantaged businesses.
Does anyone doubt this whole nation will be better off with these investments? The rich will be just as well off, the middle class will do better, and everybody will do better.
The president also would use funds tied to his proposed American Jobs Plan, including $10 billion for community-led infrastructure projects and $31 billion in small business programs to increase access to capital. The Tulsa Centennial has also fueled a national conversation about reparations for centuries of slavery and racial discrimination.
And Yamiche joins me now. So Yamiche, tell us a little bit more about the reaction to the president's visit to Tulsa today and more about what he is saying about how to address the enormous racial wealth gap in this country.
Well, President Biden's history-making trip was definitely welcomed by many people, but it was also met with a lot of questions that remain unanswered tonight. So President Biden spoke at length about the massacre in Tulsa. He said that this was really a scar on our nation's history. He said that this is something that we need to learn about, that a nation really needs to confront and deal with and contend with its dark past. But he also talked about the fact that he needs to do more and that the country needs to do more right now to deal with this racial wealth gap. gap, which is why you saw the White House today roll out these initiatives. The big question, though, is what can be done for the people of Tulsa right now? There are survivors that the president met with who are 106, 107 years old, who say that right now they are not able to pay their bills. They were never able to close, go to school. And there are a lot of people who are wondering whether or not there should be reparations for those people right now. The White House is not answering that question. They do say that the president supports a study on reparations. That being said, the president did also announce that Vice President Harris, she's going to be leading the administration's effort on fighting back against Republican-led efforts when it comes to voting rights. The president said that Republicans are really doing un-American things in trying to restrict voting. Of course, Republicans have said that a lot of those laws are aimed at voter integrity, even though there was no widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election.
And Yamiche, how are these proposals being received? We know there's already quickly come some criticism of what the president did not talk about.
That's right. So the president talked a lot about disadvantaged communities and really trying to work on lessening this racial wealth gap. But there are a number of people, including the president of the NAACP, who are saying the president really needs to deal with student loan debt. And they say, the NAACP, that that disproportionately impacts Black Americans, especially Black students. And they say until you start talking about student loan debt, you can't get to home ownership. You can't get to business ownership because people are tied down with that sort of debt. Now, the president, when he was a candidate, said that he was supportive of a plan that would wipe out, erase, that is, $10,000 worth of student loan debt for each American. But since his election, he has not moved forward with any plans like that. The White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, he says that they're looking into whether or not the president can wipe out student loan debt with only executive action. That is a question still hanging in the air. So student loans is really top of mind, and the president did not deal with that today.
Yamiche Alcindor reporting on President Biden's visit to Tulsa today. Thank you, Yamiche.
Thank you.
And Tulsa's history is casting a larger light on the long-term effects of institutional racism, lost income and opportunities, and the toll this all takes on the financial well-being of Black Americans. The wealth gap that Yamiche just mentioned and reported on is believed to have widened last year during the pandemic, and it exists among all levels of education. We explore this now in the president's initiatives with William Darity. He's a professor of economics and African American studies at Duke University. He has long studied and written about this. Professor Darity, very good to see you. Thank you so much for joining us. We know what happened in Tulsa 100 years ago, horrible in human terms. What about in economic terms? What did it mean over time, not only for the people of Tulsa, but more broadly for Black Americans across this nation?
So it's been estimated that the property losses, apart from the casualties and death, the property losses are estimated at a present value of in excess of $600 million today. And the implications across time have to do with the deprivation of resources for multiple generations. Tulsa's only one example or one instance of this type of atrocity. There were upwards of 100 massacres of this type that took place in the United States from the end of the Civil War into the 1940s, which had tremendous implications for the capacity of previous generations of Black Americans to provide resources for subsequent generations.
And you've done a lot of thinking, a lot of writing about what is due. Not only the individuals who experienced these massacres, riots across the country, but to Black Americans across time. And what in general do you believe is owed?
So I believe that the difference in wealth between Black and white Americans best captures the cumulative intergenerational effects of all of these atrocities, including the fact that at the very end of the Civil War, Black Americans were promised 40-acre land grants that were never delivered. And so if we look over time, the Black-white wealth gap is a consequence of what has occurred over multiple generations, and it captures the disadvantage that has accumulated for current generations. And it amounts to $840,900 on average between a Black and white household. Another way to think about this is Black Americans who have ancestors who were enslaved in the United States constitute about 12% of the nation's population, but possess less than 2% of the nation's wealth. So if we're going to close that gap, it would require us to make a national expenditure in excess of $11 trillion.
$11 trillion, an enormous sum. And what we are hearing from President Biden today is, among other things, he's talking about addressing housing inequities, taking a number of specific steps to try to ensure that the racial gap in the value of homes and the availability of housing is improved. He's also looking at economic opportunity, helping businesses. How far do steps like these go toward accomplishing the kind of broad reparations you're speaking about?
So this is a situation in which the proposals are not necessarily bad ideas, but they won't go very far in terms of eliminating racial wealth differences. The amounts are simply too small, and the focus is targeted on specific asset areas that are not necessarily the full range of assets in which there's a difference in Black and white wealth ownings. So if you look at the typical Americans' combination of assets, about 25% are attributable to an individual's primary residence. But a remaining 75% is attributable to retirement accounts, stocks and bonds, business ownership, and non-residential real estate. And so a focus exclusively on home ownership is not going to get us very far. And the amount that's proposed is extremely small relative to the entire gap.
Well, the Biden administration at this point is not speaking about, they're not taking a position on reparations. They've said it's something that they are studying. But one can assume that part of what's going on here is the political reality of how difficult it would be to get something of that magnitude passed through the Congress when the president is having a hard time even getting something like infrastructure through.
So it's over 155 years due. But you're correct. I don't think it's likely that a serious reparations plan would pass the current Congress. However, there has been a sea change in public attitude about reparations for Black Americans. In the year 2000, only about 4% of white Americans endorsed reparations. By the year 2018, that percentage had risen to 16, low, but definitely not 4%. And today, the best estimates suggest that it's about 30% of Americans who endorse the idea of reparative justice for Black Americans. So the momentum is moving in the right direction. We'll have to see if this is something sustainable. But other types of policies like the president is proposing fall far short from addressing the racial wealth gap.
I hear what you're saying, Professor Darity. They fall short, and we didn't mention the aid the president's speaking about in terms of transportation, where entire communities have been split open and divided because of highways, for example, that have gone through. But are these kinds of steps, are they harmful, or is it that they just, can they even count as first steps toward what you were saying is necessary?
If they were indeed steps that held the promise for a comprehensive effort in the future, then I'd be more enthusiastic about them. These are not bad things to do. They just will not have much of an effect on the Black-white wealth.
And finally, if you could say something right now to President Biden about what else he should do, what would it be?
I think it would be very, very exciting and encouraging if he were to appoint a presidential commission to address the history of racial atrocities in the United States and design a full-scale proposal for reparations. He has said that he's in favor of some type of commission, but it seems that it's a congressional commission that he's referring to. I think it would be very impressive if we had a presidential commission to take on that task.
Professor William Darity of Duke University, we thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Costa Rica meeting with leaders from Central America. One of the likely topics will be vaccine equity as the COVID-19 crisis across Latin America and the Caribbean worsens. Today in Peru, the government revised the official death toll, almost tripling it to 180,000, making it the worst death rate per capita in the world. It's where the NewsHour's Ali Rogan begins her report.
In Lima, Peru, sprawling hillside cemeteries are reaching their limits, leaving the family of COVID-19 victim Joel Bautista desperate.
We have decided to bury him in the garden in front of my house because there is no solution. What else can I do with my dead brother in my house?
The Bautistas found a burial plot at the last moment, but across Latin America, families like them are dealing with a devastating second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. Argentina has been under strict lockdown since late May, when cases skyrocketed. South America's largest soccer tournament, the Copa America, was supposed to take place in Argentina. But on Monday, officials moved it to Brazil, where cases also remain high. Some Brazilians said the move was misguided.
The country is not yet ready to host Copa America because of the health issues. They have not taken care of those of us here. Imagine those who come from other countries.
In Colombia, intensive care units are stretched beyond their capacities. In Ecuador, this hospital turned a cafeteria into a COVID ward, then added tents as the numbers grew.
In recent weeks, the hospital is at 130% to 150% of its capacity.
In May, Latin America and the Caribbean accounted for about 30% of COVID deaths worldwide, despite being only 8% of the global population. COVID variants are among the chief culprits. The P1 strain, first detected in the Brazilian Amazon, has spread throughout the region. In Peru, officials say it's caused 40% of new cases.
We are certain of the presence of the Brazilian variant, with cases in between 8 and 10 regions around the country where we have a significant frequency of it.
Critics blame Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro for what they say is a cavalier attitude.
To health professionals, we regret the deaths from COVID and the other deaths in Brazil, but we must face the problem. Life goes on. We're already talking about the third wave. If the third wave comes, we will also have the fourth, fifth, sixth, infinite waves. Of course, we hope against it, but we must face it.
Bolsonaro discouraged social distancing and face masks. He dismissed COVID-19 as a little flu and encouraged the use of the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine as a cure. In Brazil's largest cities, tens of thousands of protesters demonstrated over the weekend, blaming Bolsonaro for the high death toll.
Impeachment now. Out with Bolsonaro. I can't stand him anymore. There will be more deaths if he stays on.
The COVID pandemic is due to a disastrous policy from the federal government, of an anti-scientific policy of denial that goes against social distancing because of the claim it will profoundly affect the economy.
A low vaccination rate is making matters worse. As of late May, only 3% of people in Latin America and the Caribbean were fully vaccinated. The United States has come under pressure to share its vaccine surplus with Latin America, in part to counter China's conditional vaccine diplomacy. Honduras has struggled to get Chinese vaccines because of its diplomatic ties with Taiwan. Neighboring El Salvador, an ally of China, donated some of its stockpile.
The Salvadoran people are with the Honduran people with this humanitarian donation going beyond borders.
China is also sending vaccines to Uruguay. Seen as an initial success story, the country's cases are surging. It secured enough vaccines for just over half its population. President Luis Lacalle Pou said China's help signified strengthening ties.
We are ready to upgrade our bilateral cooperation in the area of health. I would consider it very firmly.
In some cases, even aggressive vaccine diplomacy is insufficient. So far, Bolivia has only received about 5% of the 5 million doses it expected from Russia.
Since the vaccination of people with kidney diseases and cancer began, the process has accelerated a little. But we see this could go on until 2026 or even 2027.
As the virus worsens all over the region, it's exposing deep fractures between governments and citizens. In Colombia, demonstrators defied second-wave lockdowns starting in late April, responding to a planned middle-class tax hike intended to help the pandemic-stricken economy. But even after President Iván Duque withdrew it, the marches grew, as did the demands. Now, protesters are calling for widespread government and police reform.
Colombia has lost its fear and will keep on until there is real change.
Police are using increasingly brutal tactics. Since protests began, 63 people have died and hundreds have been reported missing. Health officials worry that deaths will continue to rise as protesters contract COVID-19.
We can't continue like this. We need to take measures so as to resolve the political issues of the country. But now it is a matter of life and death.
Across the region, the COVID crisis is also fueling an economic one. In Chile, the government is allowing citizens to draw down their pensions for a third time, which economists say is only forestalling a bigger disaster.
It is the only available alternative. But this is like selling your fridge to buy food. The reality is you're making it worse.
But the people of Latin America are also determined to make it better. In Medellin, Colombia, a group of engineers and physicians responded to a ventilator shortage by building their own model from scratch. Mechanical engineer Mauricio Toro spearheaded the project.
One of the biggest challenges that we had was all the parts that were necessary for the ventilators were not available. So we ended up having to manufacture parts locally to tweak existing parts that were not 100% the part that we needed, but modifying them and making them fit to purpose.
3 weeks later, the team had three working prototypes, which quickly made their way into hospitals.
So there was definitely a learning curve. In the team, I would say none of us had ever made a ventilator. And every time we talk to a doctor and they say, we used your ventilator and it worked as expected, just fills us with pride because we know it's one more life that we've saved.
One more life saved and one fewer addition to a growing death toll in a region in crisis. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Allie Rogan.
Graduation season is in full swing at colleges and universities around the country. Even though the pandemic is easing its grip in the U.S., it has triggered many bigger questions about what schools should be doing in the months to come. We start a special series tonight and begin with the latest on community colleges. They have long been seen as an opportunity for students of all backgrounds to earn a degree. But those same students have been some of the hardest hit by the pandemic, and many have had to drop out. Hari Srinivasan reports for our series, Rethinking College.
May of 2019, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was carrying my second son. I was 16 weeks pregnant.
Come on, guys!
By the time Fandria Preston finally finished her cancer treatment, COVID-19 had shut down much of the country. But after 10 years as a medical assistant, in the middle of a pandemic, the mother of three decided to go to community college.
My husband was like, you need to do something. He was like, you know how you're a task-oriented, driven person. He was like, you're gonna need to do something. So he was like, go to school for cybersecurity.
Now, in her first semester at Northern Virginia Community College, Fandry is able to do all of her classes online, take care of her kids at home, and is already applying for jobs. But that's not the story for many community college students in the U.S. right now. Between the fall of 2019 and the fall of 2020, nationwide enrollment in public two-year colleges dropped 10%. This spring, the slide continued, and it was even worse among students of color. Colleges enrolled around 14% fewer Black and Latinx students and nearly 20% fewer Indigenous students.
My youngest son was getting an award at school, and he didn't tell me. And as a mom, that really broke my heart. It was kind of in that moment I knew that I needed to get one job that would be able to help me provide for my family.
At the time, Felicia Oscar was working three jobs. But now, the single mother of six is working on her associate's degree at Madera Community College in Central California. She's a survivor of domestic violence and wants to use her degree to one day open a shelter.
I wake up at 3 a.m. in the morning and I put a computer desk and a computer in my closet so that I could actually have a quiet area to study.
But when the coronavirus came to California, work dried up and the family was forced to stay at home. For Felicia, school became overwhelming.
Our internet wouldn't work. Then we couldn't, the Zooms were crashing. There was no space. So you got to think about it. There's six Floyd children. right? From college all the way down to elementary. Plus me, I'm in college. We're all trying to log into Zooms. We're all trying to do our homework. It's just so much noise. It was so, you couldn't focus.
So last summer, she dropped out.
And this is a highlight palette.
After getting a makeup resale business up and running and better adjusting to remote life, Felicia had enough funds and confidence to return to school last fall. So what should schools be doing for students like you?
I know a lot of people lost their jobs. So there was a worry about food or rent. Just remind them of the services available, that there's support, you know, there's psychological services on campus. There's counselors, academic counselors on campus.
At the College of Southern Nevada, the state's largest college, they're hoping to bring back students like Felicia. This fall, the school's enrollment declined 12% from the year before. The school sits in the heart of Las Vegas. That's a hub for hospitality and tourism. And at its peak last April, unemployment in the city hit 33%. Federico Zaragoza, the College of Southern Nevada's president, says the economic shutdown had an immediate impact on his students.
Financial reasons was the primary reason given for students stopping out. Almost 40% of those students had a scenario where they had to decide between rent, food, and a college expense. And many of our students were more comfortable with an in-person environment than online courses.
Zaragoza hopes that by connecting students to financial assistance, food pantries, and mental health counseling, they can help students get back on a successful career path.
Even if you have more people looking for work, if the skills that they bring aren't aligned to the skills required by employers, you're still going to have structural unemployment.
Why has this decline been so severe? Tom Brock and his colleagues at Columbia University's Community College Research Center have pored over U.S. Census data and find households with community college students are harder hit.
In a lot of these households, if the breadwinners lose their job, the person who might be going to community college might be drafted in to help the house.
Absolutely. And it's important to remember that it may be the breadwinner himself or herself who's the community college student.
But Northern Virginia Community College has been able to buck this national trend. NVCC's president, Ann Kress, says enrollment increased this year.
What did you do to make that happen?
We got out $750,000 in emergency aid very quickly. We were able to loan laptops. We turned our parking lots into Wi-Fi hotspots. We also turned individuals who work at our college into what we called remote student support specialists. They reached out to students who might be a little bit missing in action. They let them know about the aid that they would qualify for. They let them know that we were here to help them.
On top of the school's efforts, Kress says Virginia's new free community college initiative could have a significant impact on students. The program provides free tuition for low and middle income students in high demand fields, as well as funding for other expenses like transportation and childcare.
Don't touch it, don't touch.
That extra help can make a huge difference for students like Fandria Preston.
I'm not working right now due to the pandemic, and I'm trying to better myself with a career and to provide for my family in the future. So these funds are going to help me with the childcare and utilities and food to put on my table and not to worry about, oh, my lights will get cut off.
And if community colleges cannot hold on to their students, Tom Brock believes the effects could ripple across the labor force.
Community colleges largely train healthcare workers, for example. They also train students in careers like construction and welding and other things needed, quite literally, to get the economy humming again.
Some worry that even if schools can get students back in class, the average completion rate for community college students is still very low. As of 2019, only 40% of two-year college students complete their degree. But for Fandria Preston and Felicia Oscar, they know how important their education is.
I wanted my children to see how important education was. And I kind of felt like it was my responsibility as the example and the head of the household to kind of not only say it, but to act it out.
I know everyone is going through something. Everyone is. I mean, it is hard, but you have to keep pushing.
And they're both confident they won't let a pandemic get in their way. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Hari Srinivasan.
tennis star Naomi Osaka's decision this week to withdraw from the French Open has led to major reaction and new conversations about professional athletes, mental health, and the media. At 23 years old, she's not just the winner of four Grand Slams and ranked second among women in tennis. She's also the highest paid female athlete in the world. Amna Nawaz explores some of the issues this case has raised.
Judy, this all began when Naomi Osaka refused to speak to reporters after her first-round victory at Roland Garros on Sunday. She was fined $15,000. Then the leaders of the Grand Slam tournaments threatened suspension or even disqualification if Osaka did not meet her contractual obligations. Now, Osaka issued her own lengthy statement yesterday on Twitter, announcing she'd be withdrawing from the tournament to protect her mental health. She shared she suffered, quote, long bouts of depression since the U.S. Open in 2018, and also what she called huge waves of anxiety before speaking to global media. For more on this, I'm joined by Zena Garrison. She's three-time mixed doubles Grand Slam champion, Olympic gold medalist, and a former top five tennis player in the world. And also Howard Bryant. He's a sports writer and author with Meadowlark Media. He's the author of the recent book Full Dissidence and a children's book about Serena and Venus Williams called Sisters and Champions. Welcome to you both, and thank you so much for being here. Zena Garrison, I want to start with you because you know what it is to be a superstar in this sport, to compete at the highest level, the pressure that comes with it. When Osaka said she wasn't going to do those press conferences because it was bad for her mental health, what was your reaction?
Well, my immediate thought was that someone probably should have talked to her before she actually put out the statement that she wasn't doing any press. And my second thought was, you know, that she was in trouble. So I noticed that right after Miami, that she actually said she was not going to be playing some tournaments, that she needed a rest. And so I kind of felt that something was going on with her mentally. But the most important thing is that, you know, it's really tough because when you're asked to step away and you ask people to let step away and then they don't give you that opportunity and then it blows up to something else, it just builds on, more pressure comes on.
Howard, help us understand what she's talking about here, though, because Osaka says, you know, it's those press conferences, having to take these questions. Give us a sense of what goes on in that room, because a lot of people will say that this is part of the deal. When you compete at this level, you sit before journalists and you take their questions. What would you say to that?
Well, it's not just people who say that's part of the deal. It's the tournaments themselves. They're contractually obligated to be in those rooms. However, I just feel like when you're looking at this, I just see no reason why this had to escalate to the degree that it did. Here's what happens with media. Essentially, you go into press, and Zena knows this. Tennis players have the most, they're one of the athletes. It's an individual sport. It's a lonely sport. You're by yourself. And you do press after matches. There's no open locker room. It's not 24/7 access. However, immediately following wins and losses, you go, and there's a cooling off period of 15 minutes, 20 minutes. It's sometimes winners take a little bit longer time, but then you sit down and you talk. If you're going to win a championship, you're probably doing this 8 times. And over the course of a season, you're answering so many of the same questions. And I think, especially because you don't have teammates, you're being asked, especially in your deficient season, when you're looking at someone like Naomi Osaka, she was entering a period of the calendar where she does not play well. She hadn't played well on clay. She hadn't played on grass. Take that combined with the fact that you've got the Olympics looming, combine that with the fact that she's going to be asked to defend her U.S. Open championship, and then take all of that and then add to it the year anniversary, both of the murder of George Floyd and the shooting of Jacob Blake, where she took a very prominent role. And it's very, very clear that the pressure is getting to her in terms of being out front.
Zena Garrison, what about this? Because this isn't about any one thing. It's not just about the sport, just about mental health. She is a Black woman who competes in a predominantly white sport in tennis. And you can't really kind of take apart all of those issues. They're all complicated and layered together. So what about that? How much of a role do you think that plays?
Well, I was going to say that plays a big part of it. And it's a role that unless you're a Black athlete or basically an all-white sport, you tend not to understand. Sometimes it's just pressure getting in, having to be able to go to you know, to the tennis court and somebody just asks you to see your badge because they don't believe that you can play. There's little bitty things. But in Osaka's case, she made $52 million last year. So naturally, everybody's like, oh, so what's the big deal? She shouldn't have any problems or whatever. Well, she has sponsorships. She has people that are counting on her. She has to pay her team members. Everybody's pulling at her. And also, these young players, especially young tennis players, they don't really have true friends. You know, when I was growing up, I had the opportunity to have at least my high school friends that I could go and talk to. You don't talk about tennis. Now everyone around them is talking about, you know, or trying to figure out how they can make them number one or how they can get more sponsorship. So, and then you're having to rely on social media as some of your friends, or put things out that maybe you don't want to put out, and then someone comes back and says something, that's pressure within itself.
Yeah, I think Zena makes an amazing point here. I was going to say that Zena's making an amazing point that we're not paying enough attention to as well. I think we have a real generational issue here as well. I think that when you're looking at the way that this generation communicates, I think Zena made the point immediately that once this went public, you're no longer talking about mental health and talking about what's going on with Naomi Osaka. Now it's a fight. Now it's a fight between the Grand Slams, and it's between her, because I still feel like this story exploded the way that it did because the Instagram post took away any sort of behind-the-scenes diplomacy. And then the Grand Slams, instead of the French Open dealing with this individually, they go to Wimbledon, then they consult with the US Open, then they consult with Tennis Australia, and now it looks like you've got this entire industry ganging up on a 23-year-old.
Howard, let me just ask you, what about that? Now, we have the Grand Slam tournaments coming out with a statement just this afternoon saying now that they do support Osaka, they will welcome her back when she's ready, but also saying that they're going to take steps to, quote, improve the player experience at the tournaments, including as it relates to media. What did you take away from that? What does that look like?
Well, what I take away from this is that these are the conversations that should have taken place behind closed doors over the past several months. Number one, people have said that, well, you know, if you have mental health issues, you cannot guess and determine and anticipate when that's going to happen. But when you read Naomi's statement, she's been dealing with this for a few years now. She already played two clay tournaments. She played Madrid and she played Rome. And somewhere along the line, someone in her team could have said, we need to go to the French Federation and say, I'm not doing well. Is there a way? These press conferences are nowhere near worth having the number two player in the world not be there. There's no reason that this could have happened, that this happened the way that it happened, except for the fact that these sides did not communicate. There had to be a workaround. There are plenty of ways to deal with this. Everybody lost here. She is climbing to a degree right now. She's got four majors already. The fans lost. The tournament lost. Everybody has lost in this simply because of the lack of communication.
Zena, what about the mental health part of this? Because obviously there's an epidemic in America. One in every five Americans has some kind of mental health diagnosable illness in any given year. Someone like Naomi Osaka at the top of her game, number two in the world, the highest paid female athlete in the world, to come out and say this in this way, does this reveal this is actually much more prevalent at this level than we previously knew?
Well, it's very interesting because Naomi would be the one that has brought up that there's not only mental health in the world, but there's mental health in sports. And I say that because we have championed her for what she was doing for social justice. And then now, I don't think she was asking for this, but she has brought up something now that we're talking about, which has been going on for quite some time with different athletes. But for different athletes, you know, when they come out and they say they need a rest or they're doing something and they say, oh, there's something wrong with them or they're crazy, without looking into the actual background of it.
And one last thing to that, to Zena's point, is that these athletes are taught from day one, overcome. And if you don't, you're soft. If you don't, you're not tough enough. Mental toughness, Mamba mentality, all of these things. And there's no room in this because, especially in tennis, you have no coaches, you have no teammates, you have no one to talk to.
Yeah.
And so everything that you do out there is up to you. So the pressure that is on these athletes is enormous and substantial. And we make it seem like it's not a big deal because of two things. One, the enormous amount of money. And two, we have this paternalism where we say, you're making a lot to play a kid's game. It's not a kid's game. It's a $100 billion industry.
Well, for all the controversy, all the debate, Naomi Osaka has us talking about all these important issues. And that is absolutely a good first step. Zena Garrison and Howard Bryant, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After a year of grief and sorrow for so many, a new book by acclaimed author Chimamanda Adichie explores a writer's recent personal sense of loss of a beloved father. She was at her family home in Lagos, Nigeria, when she spoke with Jeffrey Brown for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Like families everywhere amid pandemic, the Nigerian-born Adichie family, spread across three continents, found a semblance of connection through Zoom.
On 7 June, there was my father, only his forehead on the screen as usual, because he never quite knew how to hold his phone during video calls. Move your phone a bit, Daddy, one of us would say.
Days later, 88-year-old James Woye Adichie was dead of complications from liver failure.
On 10 June, he was gone. My brother called to tell me, and I came undone.
The words are from Notes on Grief by James's daughter, Chimamanda Adichie, celebrated as one of the world's leading writers, author of novels such as Half of a Yellow Sun and Americana.
Culture does not make people. People make culture.
Her TED Talks, We Should All Be Feminists, and The Danger of a Single Story, calling for an openness toward the culture of others, have attracted millions of viewers.
I'm a storyteller. I'm a believer in stories. And in trying to talk about the things I care about, you know, feminism, and how important it is to have a diverse sort of world, I use stories, and I think maybe people, because there's something very universal about stories, and I think that's what maybe people respond to.
Now the story is her own, in a deeply personal essay about losing her father last year.
I'm only starting to realize how much of my sense of comfort in the world comes from having been raised by him and by my mother. And so in some ways, maybe what I would also like for people to get out of this is how important it is to be, and I know this sounds really cliche, but how important it is to be a good parent. And I wanted this book to be a tribute to what it means to be a father. He was so present and so patient, and he gave us room to be who we were.
James Adichie studied mathematics in college in Nigeria, came to the U.S. to get his Ph.D. at Berkeley, and then became Nigeria's first professor of statistics. A beloved teacher for decades, patriarch of a close-knit family.
You know, you write in the book, grief is a cruel kind of education. What did you learn about grief that most surprised you?
I was surprised to discover that I could laugh the day after my father died. And it was surprising to me that laughter is part of grief. And I also realized how much anger I felt and still feel about losing my father. And I've just been surprised by how it is such a multifaceted thing. There are moments when I think I'm fine and I'll be fine. And there are moments when I think I'm just never going to be fine. And I just was not prepared. I was not prepared for all of that.
As with so many millions losing loved ones, the pandemic added to the sense of remoteness, in her case, literal. As she was unable for months to leave her home in the U.S. to be with her extended family in Nigeria.
There's a measure, I think, of the death of a loved one being unreal, feeling that it hasn't happened. But when there's a kind of distance that, you know, Zoom calls and lockdown and airports closed, it creates a kind of distance that makes it even more surreal.
Did your personal grief give you any better sense of how to confront the collective grief of the pandemic?
I just feel a lot more compassion for different kinds of pain. that people are going through, particularly this period, you know, the pain of absence, because it's not just death. It's also one of the things I think this pandemic has done is that it has frayed human connection because we can't hug each other and we don't see each other. And screens just don't, it's just not the same thing.
In March, as this book was going to print, a second loss, the death of her mother, Grace. The T-shirt she wore in our talk reads, Daughter of Grace.
Well, does writing help? I mean, you're a writer, of course, so you write, but this seems more personal.
It does help. Writing actually does help. And when I teach writing, I like to say the standard thing, which is, you know, don't think of writing as therapy. But actually, sometimes it is. And with this little book, which is really an essay, I found it very, it was just my way of trying to find words and trying to, talk to myself, trying to make sense of things. Writing is language in general, I think, is what I turn to as a reader and as a writer. And so I found it, even after my mother died, I found myself, you know, trying to say the unsayable. And writing is the only thing that helps me do that. And reading, I should say. And reading as well.
All right. The book is Notes on Grief, Chimamanda Adichie. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's lovely talking to you.
President Biden has set a goal of 70% of Americans to have their first COVID-19 vaccine by July 4th. To get there, states and cities have to be creative in their vaccine distribution. As Gabriel Kramer from PBS station IdeaStream in Cleveland reports, small local businesses like barbershops are stepping up to help.
Barbershops are, of course, known for haircuts, beard trims, and some friendly verbal jabs.
You guys got lucky with that one.
But twice this month, Urban Cuts Barbershop on Cleveland's west side was also a place to get another kind of jab with a needle. They're offering the COVID-19 vaccine.
We are a trusted entity in the community. They know Urban Cuts, they know me.
Waverly Willis is the owner of Urban Cuts. He has a history of going the extra mile for his customers. Free haircuts for the homeless and free blood pressure screenings for any patron, mostly men.
Two or three of the gentlemen that left here earlier, they told me that I was the reason that they got the vaccine. And that makes me feel good to know that essentially, I guess they feel like they're trusting me with their lives.
So when the Cleveland Department of Public Health sought to recruit businesses to distribute the vaccine, it's no wonder that Urban Cuts was the first business to opt in. Shan Smith did not get a haircut last weekend. He just came to the barbershop to get his shot.
I thought about not getting a shot at all, honestly. When I saw that this gentleman here was willing to make this available in his facility, at the very least, I could support him while helping others at the same time. You know, it's all about community anyway.
Barbershops aren't the only out-of-the-ordinary locations offering COVID-19 vaccines. In Cleveland's Slavic Village neighborhood, the Third Federal Savings and Loan turned its parking lot into a drive-through and walk-up vaccination site. One of the first in line was Third Federal employee Tiffany Watson.
That's why I came, because I didn't want to have to figure out when I'm going downtown, how I have to park, or where I'm going, how do I call to get it. So I figure while I'm working, I can just go.
The convenience was intentional, but not just for employees. Anyone was welcome to get shots, which were given by Metro Health Hospital staff.
People work, people have different kinds of life situations and different kinds of barriers. So again, I think the idea is that we need to try all kinds of new things, pull down those barriers, and just make sure that folks can make choices that they feel comfortable making.
Over at the barbershop, the goals were the same. Make the vaccine easier to get and provide a comfortable place to get it.
I'm going to continue to use Urban Cuts as a vehicle to help our community out.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Gabriel Kramer in Cleveland.
Such a great idea. Creative, and it takes everybody pitching in. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.